Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we welcome Dakota political junkies John Hunter and Jonathan Ellis. John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. We have him by phone from Madison. John, welcome.
Hi, Lori. Thanks.
Jonathan Ellis writes for the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls. Jonathan Ellis joins us from Sioux Falls now. Jonathan, hi.
Hey, Lori.
I think we best start with the news of the day and a shooting in Alexandria, Virginia. Jonathan Ellis, you've been kind of monitoring the response as people are sort of processing this on social media and Twitter. What have you been seeing?
Oh, boy. Twitter is a cesspool. From the response from our own congressional delegation, of course, has been appropriate, expressing sympathy, that kind of thing. But and of course, none of our three members of the delegation were not there. But within the Twitter universe, you get all kinds of just nasty vitriol every time something tragic or something like this happens on both sides across the political spectrum. And maybe I shouldn't say across. Maybe I should say on the two extremes. But you get just a ton of this stuff, and so. And also, you have to be very careful as events like this play out, whether or not you're actually getting facts and that kind of thing. So it's just one of those days on Twitter. For those of you who are not on Twitter, you'd be happy you're missing it.
John Hunter, I did not spend the morning on Twitter as I was getting ready for today's broadcast. Did I miss a whole lot, do you think?
Well, good for you. Yeah, as Jonathan described it, I mean, his description of the cesspool is even generous, maybe. It's just an awful circumstance where people are cheering the shooting because they're of a different political party than the victims, and it's just an awful situation. It made me think at least a little bit. I defend the people's right to speech in America. I mean, I defend it all the time, and I think we should allow people to speak whatever they would like. But I think that sometime you have to have some discernment as to what you listen to or what you read or what you forward that isn't yours. And so I think I'm a little surprised that people monitor so much or at least read so much of things written by people who weren't there or don't have the facts or expressing these opinions. So I think sometimes it's we all have the right to speak, but sometimes I think we should turn off the volume and not listen to such awful stuff.
How does it, what's the impact on news organizations who are already under the pressure, to get the latest facts, to put things online as quickly as possible, and then throw in this whole social media component, Jonathan, where everybody is, throwing out their opinions and their nastiness and their prayers and whatever they want. It's a big muddy mess to try to sort through what the real facts are as we know it right now.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, social media traditional media perspective has become indispensable to getting, stories out to people, whether it be on Facebook or Twitter. But then you've got all of this garbage on the side of people who you get regular people who are legitimate people, but then you throw in the whole, especially on Twitter, the anonymity of what we call trolls, who are just vicious. And then there's just a lot of noise. And so, as John says, if you can be discerning in where it is you're getting your information, you will be a much happier person, I believe.
And John, I'm also wondering what this says about our expectations from our congressional representatives to respond on Twitter. And we're looking for what they say, how soon they say it, and it puts an extra sort of responsibility on them to comment on everything as well.
Well, I think that's a really interesting observation, Lori, in that it's, to some people at least, the exact wording of a message of sympathy or the timing sometimes matters. I mean, I think if someone expresses sympathy to another person in a time of loss, it shouldn't be scrutinized because they used a particular adjective or it took 3 minutes to post that instead of two or something. So it is a weird world. This is kind of uncharted territory for all of us. And you asked about kind of those of us in the media, and it's just a little weird to have this stuff flying around, kind of while you're trying to stick to fundamentals, journalistic fundamentals. I think eventually people, start to look to sources that they trust and know. And if you really want to find out, you don't look to all this vitriol. You maybe go to a source that you've relied on before, or that you rely on currently. And that's what I think news media organizations try to do: differentiate themselves by doing it well and not doing it poorly.
Let's expand the conversation and sort of go off in this direction of First Amendment and bring in conversations about the lawsuit that's happening for BPI, ABC, defamation lawsuit, questions about the First Amendment. Jonathan Ellis, you've have some things on ArgusLeader.com with updates on the court case, so let's let you start with where we're at in the case right now.
Well, the plaintiffs, obviously BPI, have been bringing their case, and I don't know how much background we need on what the case is about, but it's Beef Products Incorporated sued ABC after a series of 2012 reports that ABC made about their core product, which was a lean, finely textured beef, and ABC referred to it as pink slime. So it's so the trial has been ongoing now. It's been I think this is probably the eighth day after jury selection down at Elk Point. For those of you who have not seen, I mean, the courtroom itself is in the basement of the Union County Courthouse there. There's no windows. It's just kind of stark, which is of interest for a lot of us who live in South Dakota. We have these beautiful, ornate courthouses across the state, and this is in this basement. But so anyway, we've had some interesting testimony the last couple of days. I mean, we had Diane Sawyer, who was originally named one of the defendants in there. She testified via video deposition yesterday that she thought the reporting, the ABC was reporting, was fine. You've had some expert witnesses on the other side, however, say that they felt that ABC was not inclined or not attempting to get the full side of the story, and it was slanting their coverage. So it's going to be a very interesting case as it sort of rolls out, and we're expecting it to go well into July. With many more experts to come, and obviously the defense will put on their case once the plaintiffs are done.
John Hunter, can you tell me why this is so significant that it is a case in South Dakota, specifically as it relates to the potential damages, should BPI be victorious in this case?
Well, there's no question that, no one is questioning in this trial that BPI has been damaged by this. Now, and it was part of due to today's media environment too, where once that phrase was out in the public, and ABC is a widely watched network, that essentially it killed that product for BPI. And you can imagine if people said, oh, does McDonald's buy this? And then if they did, then McDonald's needs to respond right away and say, oh, yeah, we just found out about this. We're not going to do it anymore. And so the question is ABC misrepresenting what, either someone said or what this kind of thing is? So it is a little bit kind of eagerly watched by a lot of people to see what can be reported on. Certainly there are much worse things put out on social media or other sources today that people won't be sued for, certainly not for this amount of money. So I think at least part of the target, the fact that ABC is a huge, it's owned by Disney and also owns ESPN and other kinds of properties, that they're kind of a big money thing. So there's, no one would sue any of the three of us for saying pink slime because we don't have any resources that would satisfy the defendant. So we're watching it very carefully, and I don't know how it's going to turn out.
Jonathan, repercussions for agriculture in South Dakota. If BPI is successful, does this sort of, pave the way for more cases of its kind in the future?
Well, certainly First Amendment advocates believe that's a potential. I mean, a lot of this case is built upon a 1994 law that passed in South Dakota, that agricultural disparagement law that many people think violate the First Amendment to begin with. But Regardless, I mean, the act itself makes it a crime for somebody to knowingly to put out false information about an agriculture product that the public doesn't use, questions of safety or anything, something like that. And it also calls for treble damages. BPI has claimed about $1.9 billion in damages since those reports, and if you treble those, you get to close to $6 billion. So it's possible that, you know, should BPI prevail here, there would be a chilling effect on any kind of reports or what comments that people want to make about, you know, agriculture products.
John Hunter, implications for First Amendment? How is it playing out in the world of journalism? How are journalists talking about this case?
Well, that's also a good question. I think most people believe that journalists have responsibility to report what is going on in the world and to interview people and allow them to do that. I think there's some discussion of how much journalists should interject their own thoughts and feelings into those kind of things if it's not labeled opinion. So whether it's a news item that is, I think the public criticism of being slanted, if you're a major television news network, there appears to be at least some slant toward a political party. You listen to Democratic news or Republican news. And so, again, I think I go back to some fundamentals. It's our responsibility as journalists to try to describe the truth and let people decide, once you tell them the truth, on their own, what's right and what's wrong.
Let's switch over to our own special session in Pier and compromise reached on non-meandering waters issues. John Hunter, you want to give us an update on this and how it's sort of playing out? Does it feel like the session kicked the can down the road, or does it feel like they came up with a reasonable compromise that can keep the conversation going? Huh? How are people sort of viewing the results?
Well, I think just the latter there, where it's a compromise that needed to happen. The court ruling that shut down all this was probably not acceptable to anyone. So we knew that the compromise needed to happen. Sometimes the definition of a good compromise is that no one's happy that you can get that. But I do think it will be discussed further. In fact, it's required to be discussed further because there's a sunset clause on this action that expires in next June 30th. So it's a tough issue. We've talked about it on this program before. You can see both sides of it. There are more than just two sides of this as well. But I think, and I can't remember the legislator who said it, said this is about, recreation and respect. Those are the two big things. And, property rights respect. So there's a lot of different sides of this. I think the compromise was necessary. This is probably as good as you can come up with on kind of short notice. And yes, it will. I think it'll be approached again. Maybe it'll be improved. But I think there'll never be everyone entirely happy because there are multiple sides to this.
John Hunter, shouldn't everything be about whatever it's about and respect? We should just throw that in there for...
Right.
This is a conversation about the First Amendment and respect.
Let's start there every time.
Let's start with respect. All right, we've covered Twitter as a cesspool, fundamentals of journalism matter, and sometimes the definition of a good compromise means no one's happy. So, Jonathan Ellis, I want to talk a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing in the Argus Leader about World War II survivors, and I haven't read it all, so I'm going to... it's on my reading list, and I'm really excited to spend some quiet time digging into it because you do such great work. But tell me a little bit about this latest work.
Oh, well, thanks. I'm happy to hear that John can get back on to Lake Madison after the special session.
Should have asked that. Wait, let's go back.
We've got some stories.
The story of the 147th Field Artillery Regiment that was they were activated a full year before the war, before America got into the war. Initially, they were going to be used to fortify the Philippines, but the Japanese surprise attack and thankfully for them, they were not sent to the Philippines, but instead were diverted to Australia, where they participated in the defense there of Australia, and then the long haul through the Pacific. But that was a South Dakota unit, and sort of those were guys who were activated in 1940, so they were going to be much older than, you know, several years older than some of the youngest guys who were in that war. So we're losing them. And I had a story about a group of the men who were from D Battery here in Sioux Falls, and you know, one of them had died in April, and we had one more who was still alive that we know of, and he lives in Arizona, and still a great guy to talk to. He's calling me, picks up the phone, and you can have a great conversation with him. But, you know, the question was he'd recalled that they'd bought a bottle of champagne many years before, and so it was supposed to go to the last survivor, and we found the bottle of champagne. It was with, interestingly, a guy, his family. He'd actually served in the 147th. His name is Nathan Hall, and he'd served in the 147th. So they had the bottle of champagne. It was kind of this interesting story about what had happened to it, and I think my guy in Arizona, Jack DeWar, hopes that that Nathan Hall will keep the bottle because he's another 147th veteran who had served in Iraq. So there's some kind of continuity there.
Wow. You can find that on ArgusLeader.com. And I'll leave you, gentlemen, with a story about my uncle who was in World War II. I know, Jonathan, you'll appreciate it. But when I was in the Marines, I was stationed in the Philippines, spent time in Subic Bay and down in Manila, flew home and was talking to my uncle who was a colonel in the Army. And he said, well, I was in the Philippines. And I said, really? Did you ever get to Manila? And he looked at me and said, no, there were some Japanese in the way. And that was the moment that I realized I really didn't know what I thought I knew about the world.
Wow. Yeah.
And those stories matter from those folks. And, yep, my uncle is no longer with us. So we'll pass that on to you. Jonathan Ellis, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your work and your time.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori.
John Hunter, always a pleasure. We appreciate your insight and your time.
Thanks, Lori and Jonathan.